I'd like to welcome our next speaker, James Sidoros. I didn't pronounce that too badly.
That's fine.
He's a Christian evangelist and apologist from the UK. He received his doctorate at the University of Hertfordshire, England, where he holds a tenure as a research fellow. As a published author and speaker, he travels the nations ministering the gospel of Jesus Christ to crowds of up to 80,000. He now lives with his family in the USA, where he aims to continue his work as evangelist and make an important contribution to Christian apologetics. Today, James will focus his session on the need for a new kind of a Christian apologetic for Generation Z, those typically born from 1995 to 2010, with various authors describing as the first post-Christian generation. He has a table out there, so if you want to speak to him, want to talk to him later, I'm sure he'll be happy to. Let's welcome James.
We have the microphone back.
Okay, try that.
Not better.
Just want to make sure it's not too loud. Great.
A loud voice, anyway. Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for the ASA accepting my abstract. Some of you may have read the abstract, some of you may not, but there's a main argument. And in that abstract, before I go on to the argument, I just want to define what Generation Z is. So some of you may know that, some of you may not. But Generation Z are basically those people who are born, and the dates are not exact. Okay, so you can look at the literature. The dates vary from generation to generation, but thereabouts, okay? People born between 1995 and 2010, and they've been described as the millennials on steroids, okay? So I'm a Generation X, and many of you are Generation X. We have the millennials who are Generation Y, and we have the Generation Zers, and they are the influencers of tomorrow. They cannot be ignored. So moving on, this is my argument from the abstract. Because increasing numbers of people are rejecting Christianity, so that's broad, okay? There are many numbers increasing, rejecting the Christian faith more than ever before, especially from among Generation Zers. So I will sort of abbreviate them to Generation Z, Gen Z, Gen Zers, you know what I mean, okay? Apologetics, in particular, requires transformation. So, as an evangelist, I win souls. I travel the nations, I win souls. And I got involved in apologetics because I discovered that evangelists, they're pretty good at winning souls, but they're not so good at winning arguments. And that can be counterproductive, right? But then you get apologists who are great at winning arguments, not very good at winning souls. So I think the two actually should go hand in hand. If you don't have evangelism embedded and linked with apologetics, what is it all for? Is it just there for us to pontificate about our special fields, have great intellectual debates that make no impact for Christ? And I don't believe that's what Christ intends. I believe apologetics is to give a thorough defense of the gospel that will lead people to Christ, that will change hearts and win souls. Amen? So that's where I'm coming from. But the gospel, here's the thing, the gospel is sacred, but the method of delivery isn't. And so that means it's okay to change the way we communicate the Christian faith. So I'm going to give you an example about that. And I don't mean this, I'm not trying to be disparaging of any particular race, but it's just a real story that happened, and there's a point to be made about how just slight changes with the way that we communicate can make an impact. We had a Vietnamese maid. I was living in Cyprus with my family. We had a Vietnamese maid at home, and she wanted to make a phone call to her husband in Vietnam. So I said to her, okay, bring me your husband's telephone number. So she comes to me and brings me what looked like an email address. So we weren't sort of really getting anywhere fast. So I said, give me your husband's telephone number to make the call. And so she came back with some other, I don't know, address. It wasn't, it would look like a postal address. It wasn't a telephone number. So anyway, to cut a long story short, this went on and on and on. We were going nowhere. So in the end, I just said to her, give me husband's telephone number now. And then immediately she said, okay. And she went and got the number, tried the first time, it worked. So I just changed my communication just slightly, but she understood. And that's my point. Now the point here is about changing what we're doing so we get a response, so that we become clearly understood by these Generation Zers. And so, moving on. What I want to say here is a little bit of a preamble. Evangelicals are at a pivotal point in their relationship to American culture. Former President Obama once said, whatever we once were, he said, we are no longer a Christian nation. Now, that's probably the only time I'll ever agree with Obama. And I'm sure many of you here too. But he has a point to be made. America has many Christians, but I don't believe it's any more longer a Christian nation. We need to do something about that. And in fact, many authors are describing North America and Europe as post-Christian, meaning there is a loss of the primacy of the Christian worldview. Post meaning after Christian. And so my biggest concern is that many of us don't understand the critical juncture in which we are facing right now. And if we don't understand it, we will fail in reaching this generation for Christ. And the Bible applauds men for understanding the times in which they lived. And here's an example from 1 Chronicles 12:32, how people, the tribe from the Issachar, who were 200 leaders, and we have many leaders here today, but these men understood the signs of the times in which they lived, and they took a course of action. The best course of action they thought. And that's what I believe we ought to be doing. Understanding the signs of our times. And here's some of the signs of our times, which I'm sure many of you will agree with. There's been great economic uncertainty. During the last 25 years, we've seen two recessions. There's been global instability, massive technological advances beyond what I ever thought would happen 20 years ago. And by the way, I heard that YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, they're all merging together. I don't know if you've heard the news. And it's going to be a new platform called New Twitface. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. Changing demographics. I mean, open borders, immigration, that's changing the landscape of demographics across continents. We also have the rise of Islamic extremism. We've got moral relativism. And probably one of the most sacred Christian institutions of all time, marriage and family. That's all being redefined in this generation. And so, and this is my point. This is where I want to get to. This is what Generation Z has been experiencing the last 25 years. And so, I believe it's the most important generation for three reasons. And here's a graph to illustrate that. First of all, let's talk about the nuns. One of the big features of the signs of our times is that there's been a sharp increase of people who do not identify with any kind of religious identity. And that's a very, very sharp increase for adults under 30. So you can see those are mostly Generation Zers. They're called the nuns. And that's what I want to address. So they constitute... And by the way, it's not just in America. Look at UK here. Research from the British Election Study shows that adults 25 and under also don't identify with any religious identity. So these are people who will not say whether they're Christian or any from any other religion, but there is a sharp increase of let's say, people who don't have any religion at all. But among Generation Zers, this is the biggest right now. For example, atheism, right, first of all, they were an important generation because they constitute the biggest percentage of the US population right now, 25.9%. So that's my first reason why I'm focusing on them. The second reason is they will account for 40% of consumers by 2020. And thirdly, atheism is double among Generation Zers at 13%. The rest of the US population is 6%. And so that's very worrying indeed. And so the Generation Z won't merely influence American culture, they will constitute American culture. It's not that Gen Zers reject the idea of God. Okay, they may not have any religious identification, but they may still believe some supreme power exists. But they just simply ignore him. They're not interested. Most of them don't care, and that's the point. And while apologists provide the what answers, Gen Zers, they care about the why. Why should God matter? Why should I care? What difference would faith make to me? This is not philosophical atheism, this is functional atheism. And the one factor driving their rejection of Christianity is a perceived divide between science and the Christian faith, science and the Bible. And only 28% of Gen Zers see science and the Bible as complementary. And so we have to adapt in the way that we're trying to reach this generation. The first step we have to do, right, those are just some of my points that I raised earlier. The first thing we have to do is understand them. If we want to reach them, we have to understand them. And here's a few points that I want to sort of unpack for you in understanding them. They're the first generation in the West to grow up in a post-Christian culture. The first generation of the 21st century. And although 78% believe in the existence of God, that's what coming from Pew Research, only 59% consider themselves Christian. But here's the worrying thing, only 4% hold a biblical view. So while 59% of them believe or identify as Christian, the research shows that a tiny percentage of them understand what Christianity is and hold a biblical view. They've grown up in a post-9/11 world marked by global terrorism. Attacks in places like Paris and London and Spain and so on not only create the reality of what life has always been like for them in the here and now, but it creates anxiety for the future. They worry about a dystopian, totalitarian future. And that's what explains why a lot of them are turning to socialism. They grew up during the effects of the 2008 recession. And so, arguably, that's the worst global downturn since World War II. And this has led to them having a coping mechanism that includes acute aspirations. And my kids, for example, have a strong sense of resourcefulness. They're a little bit frugal with their money. They're willing to save it. They want to save because they've seen tough financial times. They've experienced it by looking at the effects of the recession. And they're more private than millennials. They prefer discrete social platforms like Snapchat, Secret, and Whisper. And according to a Pew study, 50% have never posted anything online due to privacy concerns. And the ones that do, they seek to create an ideal image of themselves by constructing different social media personas to suit different audiences. This shows us how self-conscious they really are. And they're the most culturally diverse generation. For them, diversity is just a natural concept that they've lived in. But they're also passionate about making a difference in the world. They want to play an active role in making the world a better place. MTV conducted a nationwide survey of 1,000 Gen Zers to see how they identify themselves. They came up with the name, The Founders, because they want to create or found a new world. And so they do want to make an impact, and they see themselves as taking to task cleaning up the world from previous generations. And so they're quite ambitious individuals. But they also never knew a world without the World Wide Web, thanks to Tim Berners-Lee, another British guy. Thanks, Tim. In 1980, yeah, this is something that happened in around the turn of the 90s. So, you know, they've been born with the internet ready, the only generation to do that. And so they are like Wi-Fi enabled digital now, you know, natives with high technological dependency. Did you know that 92% of them go online daily? One caller go online constantly, and 91% go to bed with devices in their hands. That sounds a bit like me. So they spend an average of 9 hours a day. They absorb social media for breakfast. By 2020, they will spend more money online than any other generation. So they've grown up with this deluge of data online coming at them. And one thing that the research shows is that they possess an amazing ability to filter out unwanted information in just 8 seconds. And what I put to you is that that is not like a short attention span. That's 8 seconds of them prioritizing what they want to hear. And so the implications, there's a lot of implications. I'm not going to get through all of this, but I'm just going to cut to the chase. This is a generation which listens with its eyes and thinks with its feelings. They are very independent and self-directed. They know what they want. They don't need intermediaries to find information. They know how to find information on the internet. But the consequence of that is there's a chasm between wisdom and information. They face endless volleys of rumor masquerading as truth, so they lack discernment. They become highly influenced by what other people think. They're very self-conscious and repressed people. And the list goes on. Highly self-conscious, globally connected to social circles. And they largely, and here's another thing, they're very good at multitasking. So here's an image I thought was quite useful. This could be any one of my kids. I walked into my daughter's bedroom the other day. I saw her. She was doing her homework. She had a laptop out. She had a book out. She had earplugs in her ears, listening to music. And she had the TV on, all at the same time. And I walked in there and I said to her, how can you do your homework like this? I could never do that. But the thing is, they can do it. They're a multitasking generation. Now, I'm not saying they can all do it, but my daughter seems to be able to do it, and she gets A's consistently. So I'm thinking this is a generation that is way beyond the generation I grew up in. And the first generation, like I said, to be born into a web-enabled world, they communicate with symbols, speed, and language. If I was to just reel off some of the things that the urban slang that they use, like LOL, fam, homie, sup, Gucci, savage, shots fired, rip, roast, salty, spill the tea, cringe, lip, fleek, dead, ratchet, clutch, and skirt skirt. Would you understand what all that meant? Hands up. I haven't got a clue. Oh, you? Oh, okay. So the millennials are kind of a little bit ahead of us Generation X's. And so I'm just going to sort of finish up now. Reaching Gen Z, we've got to engage with their objections. They want to know the whys and the so whats. Why can't two men love each other and get married? So what if I have sex outside of marriage? Why do bad things happen to good people? They need to know the whys. That's what they're interested in. That's what we have to answer. And we have to use visual storytelling. They're very visual people. So I want to encourage people who are educators here, who are professors or people teaching in Sunday school or preachers, not just apologists, use as much storytelling, visual storytelling as possible. Use B-roll, sketches, video clips, animations, memes. Make everything visual. And use stories and start with a hook. You only get 8 seconds of their attention to keep their attention, so start with an attention-grabbing sentence. For example, in this paper, sessional video, you're going to discover how to survive through high school, what makes you happy, how prayer can bring you peace, how to defeat depression, how to find hope, discover your purpose in life. Make a statement loaded with benefits that they'll grab onto. And be succinct. I mean, most of apologetics books is like chewing wood. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote a book called 101 Good Reasons to Believe. It's outside. I cut to the chase. It makes an instant impact. Within 500 words, each argument, you can read them within 3 minutes, each one. So, you know, in the fast-paced Generation Z world in which they live, they can get the middle, beginning, and end of every argument just within 3 minutes. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote that book. And address emotional issues. Many of them go through loneliness, depression, fear, anxiety. They have identity crisis. You know, they've been brought up by helicopter parents who sort of overly protective and excessive, have excessive interest in their lives. And so they don't manage stress very well. They need to be taught that. So they identify with anything that can help relieve them from anxiety. Address their spiritual vacuum and illiteracy. And that's an area that's really important because many of them don't even have a memory of the gospel. They don't understand the basics of Christianity. They have a deep sense and awe of the universe, but they feel the sickness of an empty world. And they need to hear a gospel that calls them from darkness to greatness, from sin to salvation, from despair to hope, that can answer the wise. And herein I rest my case. Thank you very much. Any questions before we close? Yes.
Thank you for stimulating us to think about young people today. But I wonder what you'd say to the thought that perhaps while young people want those quick answers, I teach philosophy and things like that, it's very difficult to respond to why do bad things happen to good people in 500 words. And I think most people who teach about evil would say it's very difficult full stop to answer that question. How do we wrestle with theological questions too that take a lot more thought to even get close to understanding the question, let alone the answer?
That's a very good question. There are very complex answers that can't be addressed in just 500 words. My book just makes a start. It just kind of opens up the whole subject on a number of arguments. But I would say, and I get a lot of my information from just talking with my kids. I've got 5 Gen Zers. From 19, one of them's here, Joshua, to my youngest, who's 11. So I just engage in conversation and try and sort of fine-tune the way I communicate by listening to their needs and their wants. And they want bite-sized answers. You can give them a series of bite-sized answers. So you can start a series with a short description or explanation. Leave it with them wondering what happens next. So it's a bit, you're sort of like taking them through a drama and sort of dramatizing the content and making it more, dare I say, inspirational, charismatic. And just give them bite-sized answers and leaving them wanting more with lots of visuals. Any other questions?
The purpose of this message is not to get real controversial, but to mention an issue that I, so I don't want to get any fights about politics, but I know with my son, and I think for a lot of young people, they were very disturbed about the election because the young people are overwhelmingly more liberal and not supporting the president, and they see the statistics. About 85% of white evangelical Christians voting Republican in the election, And my son just basically turned him off of Christianity. So how do you respond to this? What can we do?
That's a very good point. And I think there's a lot of indictment that these Gen Zers have against other Christians and against the church. Some of their indictments are, you know, lack of tolerance, hypocrisy, contradictions, and so on. And I think we have to address those one by one by firstly us practicing and living out the Word of God for ourselves. I think with Gen Zers, and much like many other people, they do what you do. They don't do very well at doing what you say. So we have to practice tolerance. We have to practice Christian values and create that environment where they're actually feeling. They need an encounter with God. That's what I would say. And I think we're doing a very poor job at demonstrating and practicing the presence of God in that respect. We need to do better. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your ministry apart from writing this book? I know you were involved in healthcare for many years and you were an executive, but how did you come to doing this?
That's a good point. I was in healthcare for about 25 years. I had my own business, three businesses, which we grew and sold. In the United Kingdom. I sold that business in 2013, my last business, and since that time I've been a full-time evangelist traveling to the nations, and so I'm living out my passion for souls, serving the Lord in that respect. But I got involved in apologetics because for the reason I stated earlier, I saw many evangelists who are great at winning souls, not very good at winning arguments. So I've been studying apologetics since that time, and I want to sort of bridge the two together, which I think is what Paul the Apostle did.
So you do open-tent evangelism? What are you doing?
I go in and I have mass crusades and events around the world, including Pakistan and the Middle East and Asia and Europe, but I also go in and spend time with leaders in conferences and teach them about evangelism and try and impart, you know, you teach what you know, but you impart who you are. So I try and impart something of the evangelist for them to be doing the work along. I personally believe every member of the body of Christ should be a minister of the gospel. The harvest is too great just for evangelists.
Is Generation Z the same the world over?
Well, my research is limited to the West, so I haven't done. I think the results of any research on that generation would be very different if you go to the East, to Asia. So this is really limited to Western countries, what I've shared today. Yeah.
Last question.
All right. As a Gen Zer myself, there's this very powerful idea, I think, of the narrative. Something that liberal Gen Zers a lot talk about a lot, and that is, you know, the idea that arguments or positions, whether I think mostly politically or philosophically, they fit into a narrative. So, for instance, like Trump, people are upset about that because it fits the narrative of the white man who's, you know, racially insensitive, sexual predator, you know, kind of thing. And that narrative, that's where a lot of the fierce individualism comes from. So Christianity in that narrative is viewed as the religion that hates gays, the religion that argued for slavery, not the religion whose values pretty much produce liberal democracy, who helps the poor. So is there a way that you can, do you think you can like harness that idea of the narrative to turn the general perception of Christians around gender democracy? Is that
a perception that you have as a Gen Zer that Christians are bracketed as conservatives or Republicans, Trump supporters?
Yes, that is something that I see my peers doing a lot. A lot of it is very much ironically stereotyping when that's what we claim to be.
Well, I think these are answers that we all have to really think about. I personally believe we've got to have that conversation, get the conversation going with your friends, your family, your kids, other Gen Zers in the Sunday school, in the talk, get the conversation going to make them realize that that's not the stereotype of a Christian, some conservative Republican, you know, figure who is homophobic and so forth. I believe that's one of the challenges that we have to face, is spell that myth, and I believe it is a myth. But then again, quickly, what's the alternative? Because more and more liberals are turning to socialism. And if you look at communism and socialism, what did it do in the 20th century? Yeah, there's a lot of research about that. Up to 100 million people were killed under communist regimes. You know, read books by Courtois and Demel, and you realize that under the Mao regime in China, the Cambodia regime, the Moulin Rouge, and the list goes on with Stalin, 100 million people were killed under these democides. So really, that's not the utopia that I think Gen Z is thinking is either. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.